Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Today on the show, usually segregation in school is something you heard about in the South, but it turns out Wyoming had segregated schools as well.
They compare it to like the experience of African Americans in the Jim Crow South, that they treated us so bad in Worland, Wyoming, they even made us go to our own school.
The son of the late Japanese artist Paul Horiuchi shares how his father used art to stay resilient under challenging times.
My mom said that they weren't even as well off as the people in the camps because they had nothing to eat, no place to stay, no money.
And we will bring you an episode from our popular podcast, The Modern West, about a ghost town that died for a troubling reason. It's all coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Usually, segregation in school is something you heard about in the South, but it turns out Wyoming had segregated schools as well. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudalska goes back in history and takes a look at one such school in Worland.
Felix Mercado was born in Worland. His parents, originally from Mexico, had traveled around the United States, eventually settling in Worland as sugar beet farmers, where he and his five older brothers grew up.
I always bored to going to school in the fall because summers, while we were working in the fields, etc., were a little hard.
Mercado says his childhood was normal. He played with friends and his brothers. But when he entered first grade, he noticed something.
We were kept separate. There was white kids living in our neighborhood, but none of them ever went to that school.
For Mercado, this didn't seem too odd, since the school represented his community that was mostly Hispanic. But there was one thing that happened daily that he couldn't ignore. They were bused to the white elementary schools to eat lunch.
We couldn't just go out and sit wherever we wanted. They sat us in one area. And that's where we had to sit and eat our lunch. The other kids, they could get up from wherever they were sitting and go for seconds or go get an extra piece of bread. We had to raise our hand and they would bring it to us.
Turns out Mercado was attending what was known as the Spanish School, a school that was built in 1936 specifically to segregate Mexican migrants from whites. Gonzalo Guzman teaches at the University of Washington, and he studies Mexican segregation education in the Mountain West. His interest is personal.
My great-grandfather was actually recruited from Mexico in 1919 to come to Worland, Wyoming.
Guzman grew up in a community in Washington State where many had come to after leaving Worland due to the way they were treated.
They compare it to like the experience of African Americans in the Jim Crow South, that they treated us so bad in Worland, Wyoming, they even made us go to our own school.
As Guzman started researching what was known as the Spanish School, he found records of Worland school officials saying they shouldn't segregate Mexican children.
In the 1920s, there were actually a lot of school officials opposed it because they were like, you can't Americanize children by segregation. They were like, you can't, this is not the best way to do this.
Then the Great Depression happened. People lost jobs, opportunities decreased. And Guzman says all of a sudden, Mexicans posed a threat.
The psyche of people in Wyoming, white people in Wyoming, is like, we need this to reaffirm a certain identity.
Guzman says it wasn't just Worland. During the 30s, segregated schools and classrooms popped up all over the state. Torrington, Powell, Lovell, and Deaver were among those that had similar setups. Guzman says Worland stands out because they applied for and received federal relief as part of the New Deal, specifically to segregate Mexican and white kids.
That's like the first line that they say immediately. And it went to Cheyenne. So it got state approval and local approval and county approval. So this was like a concert of people working together to segregate these kiddos. Yeah.
Can I take a left in this cut here? I don't know who's in it now.
On a chilly February day, Worland historian John Davis directs me to the original building of the Spanish school.
It's two stories, and I don't know exactly how the school arrangements worked.
Yeah. Oh, it's much smaller than I expected it to be.
The brownstone building is H-shaped, and it looks like there could have been maybe four classrooms in it. Davis, who grew up in Warland, didn't know about segregation until 1955.
And I remember that distinctly because I was in the sixth grade, and for the first time there were Hispanic kids, including a very pretty Mexican girl who sat right in front of me in the sixth grade. Beautiful black hair, I remember.
Brown versus Board of Education was decided by the Supreme Court the year before. That's the case that ordered segregation to stop.
And I think that's probably what happened here, that the school people said, we can no longer justify segregation of the kind that existed.
Davis says when he was growing up, racism towards Hispanics was obvious. There were signs in restaurants, bars, and other establishments that said no Hispanics allowed. All Hispanics, like Mercado, lived on the west side of the railroad tracks. But Mercado went off to the university to become a pharmacist, came back, and bought the local pharmacy. He did pretty well for himself.
When I got married, my wife and I bought a home. There was people that weren't happy to see us move into that neighborhood. Now we're all over the town.
Today, he says he rarely sees any acts of discrimination in Warland, and the town still has a pretty large population of Hispanics for the state. But Guzman says this history has mostly been lost.
Another sad legacy of this school is how much has been lost because it's been so understudied. And this is why there's such a push now to get this recognized.
The push is to get the Spanish school on the National Register of Historic Places so that its memory isn't lost. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kudelska at the Center of the West in Cody.
When we come back, we'll bring you a segment from our podcast, The Modern West. This is Open Spaces.
This time on Human Nature, Damon faced trauma growing up in his small village in Alaska. His goal was to play pro basketball, but reaching for his dreams revealed an even larger purpose.
My senior quote was, "If all I'm remembered for is being a good basketball player, I've done nothing with my life."
Beyond the court. I'm Erin Jones. Find Human Nature under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. In this segment, we will bring you an episode from our Modern West podcast. This season has been all about rural decline and resilience. We're calling ghost towning. There are many reasons towns died, but sometimes it's for troubling reasons. Melody Edwards takes it from here.
From Wyoming Public Media and PRX, this is The Modern West, exploring the evolving identity of the American West. I'm Melody Edwards. Over the next few episodes, we're going to talk about migration to the rural West and the reason that we might be able to learn a lot about why people move someplace and why they leave. They weren't all bust towns. Some were snuffed out intentionally because of the identity of people who moved there. But a lot of those stories have been whited out in the history books. But to understand the role of migration in ghost towning, it might be time to start unearthing it. Erin Jones took on the task.
When you think of pioneers, you might think of Little House on the Prairie or Oregon Trail, that computer game you maybe played in the 90s. So, when you think of pioneers, you might think of white people. But pioneers weren't all white. This is a tale of two towns, one in Wyoming and one in Colorado. The story is told by academics, reenactors, pilgrims, the Bible, and above all, Westerners. This is a story about the American dream. Part of the American dream, especially in the West, has to do with homesteading. So historian Jake Freefeld is going to help tell this story because he specializes in homesteading.
The history of homesteading grows out of the Homestead Act of 1862, which Abraham Lincoln signed.
It was the middle of the Civil War. A year after the Homestead Act, in 1863, enslaved people were emancipated. The Civil War ended.
There is this moment of hope. The Freedmen's Bureau is founded.
The Freedmen's Bureau, a government institution that funded some hospitals and schools for African Americans.
There's a hope for land reform in the South. Many enslaved people have been working on land their entire life. I think if they can get land that they own as back wages for generations enslaved, they can make a go of it in the South.
So in 1866, still in the flush of optimism from founding the Freedmen's Bureau, Congress passed the Southern Homestead Act for anybody in the South who had supported the Union and formerly enslaved people.
Stay on that land for 5 years, prove up, and have the land forever. Well, for a number of reasons, the Southern Homestead Act didn't work out too well. Part of it was some of the lands needed clearing. So if you don't have much to begin with, you can't clear a bunch of timberland or swampland in Florida. And the other side of that is a breathtaking amount of white resistance and violence to this land reform.
In the 1870s, Congress succumbed to pressure from Southern whites and dissolved the Freedmen's Bureau and the Southern Homestead Act. All in all, Reconstruction, the attempts to make up for enslaving people for generations, lasted less than 15 years. Then, the South plunged into violence.
Yeah, the post-Reconstruction South is not a good place to be. It's violent, it is filled with increasingly segregationist laws as well. It becomes pretty clear that there's not going to be much to curb the violence, and that's when a lot of Black Americans begin moving in large part to Kansas at that period. There are some preachers in the South saying that Kansas was going to be this land of freedom, almost in this biblical sense, like a new Canaan. I'm not sure exactly how Kansas becomes the place.
But it did. Formerly enslaved people followed their dreams and came to Kansas. Over the decades, they spread into Nebraska. Have you been to Kansas or Nebraska? Imagine fields and prairie as far as you can see. Like all your dreams, your parents' dreams, of space, of room to plant and grow, to be your own person, they can come true here. Among these families were the Speeses and the Taylors. They started farming in Nebraska, and they prospered. But the sky over the plains is so big and so blue, everyone wanted to carve their piece out underneath it. And there are only so many times you can subdivide your farm among your children and their children. So, Nebraska, 1908. By now, the Civil War and chattel slavery have legally been over for 40 years. And here in western Nebraska, the Speeses and Taylors and other Black families have been successfully farming for years. But they're running out of room. And there's another issue. Racism.
The Speece family were classically trained musicians. The children would travel and put on concerts. They show up to give a concert one night, and the mostly white audience, or all white audience, is upset that it's not a minstrel show.
The Speeses were tired of the racism, and they were feeling constrained by limited land. So they got together with the Taylors and a few other Black families and made a plan. They were going to move just across the border to Wyoming and make a new home.
The town of Empire, or let's start over right there, because it was never really a town.
That's historian and anthropologist Todd Gunther. Also, what a name for a place, Empire.
The community of Empire had its origins in 1908 when several families of Black immigrants from Nebraska moved up into the Sheep Creek Valley and claimed homesteads and started farming and ranching in that area right on the Nebraska-Wyoming border.
They weren't after building a town with a main street. It didn't have a grocery store or a newspaper. Jake and Todd are adamant that it was a community, not a town. But I'm not so sure. Remember Sam Western, the economics historian from earlier in this series? He says a place is a town if it has a post office and a school. And guess what? Empire had both of those things, plus two churches. But Jake and Todd have a point too, because there wasn't a main street or like a town square or any kind of central cluster of buildings. It was really spread out and rural. But whether it was a town or a community, what matters is that it was a dream fulfilled. And this eastern Wyoming place the Speeses and Taylors chose, it's idyllic. Softly rolling hills, green crops, the odd milk cow mooing for supper. In the late summer, sunflowers line the roads, like they're happy to see you, like you're welcome here.
What they were raising was the same kind of stuff that all homesteaders raised. You know, they tried to do a little dryland farming and a few cattle and pigs and horses and mules and chickens and things like that. But the homesteads back in those days just weren't big enough for people to really make a living.
I guess, like, a question that I have is, when these folks decided that it wasn't going to work in Nebraska because of lack of land and it sounds like bigotry against them, why did they decide to keep farming at all? Like, why didn't they just move to a city or something?
That's what we call the agrarian dream. You know, Thomas Jefferson thought that the whole continent would be peopled by yeoman farmers. People thought that farming was a good and godly way to live, and that in the cities there was crime and pollution and lots of misbehavior and changing social structures and things like that. And people saw a kind of nobility in farming. And they had those skills. The Spees and Shores and Taylor families, the black families at Empire, had those agricultural skills because they'd learned all of those crafts in slavery and brought them westward with them. And they didn't like the crowds and they didn't like factory jobs and things like that. And they wanted to get back out onto the farms and be in control of their own destiny.
Being in control of your own destiny. We'll get back to Empire, Wyoming soon, but let's stay on this wistful farming ideal for a second, this dream. Remember how lots of African Americans were leaving the South after Reconstruction because it was a dangerous place to be? They left in droves for the North, for the Midwest, and for the West. So Wyoming was hardly the only place in the West where black pioneers were making a go of it. At the same time as all this was happening in Wyoming, down south, in Colorado, there was a man who was trying to make his own agrarian dream happen.
My name is O.T. Jackson, and I'm a self-made man.
Full disclosure, O.T. Jackson was born in 1862. That's not O.T. Jackson. That's reenactor John Thomas in the role of O.T. John volunteers with the Black American West Museum, and during non-COVID times, he performs at museum events. John, as O.T., is wearing a felt hat and a pocket watch in his Longmont, Colorado backyard full of roses on a gorgeous September day. It's fun to watch him. He's animated, and hearing O.T.'s story in his voice feels like insider access to something impossible. John/O.T. is telling stories of long ago. O.T. Jackson was originally from Ohio, but like lots of other African Americans, he followed his dreams west. He owned a restaurant in Boulder. He was involved in politics.
I was interested in the political environment in Denver, trying to improve the lives of Negroes. I was a member of the Negro Business League. The Negro Business League was actually a national organization. It was started by Booker T. Washington, and there were chapters all over the country. Booker T. also wrote a book, Up from Slavery, and he talked about the fact that, you know, even though slavery disappeared and we were free, most of us wound up taking care of somebody else's house or cleaning up or cutting somebody's hair or washing their clothes. And what Booker T wanted was for us to set up our own little communities. So I tried to get the Negro Business League to do that. And for some reason, they never really supported the idea. So I said, well, to hell with you guys. I'm going to do it on my own.
So O.T. and his wife Minerva bought 320 acres in eastern Colorado, not far from the border with Wyoming, and under that same wide blue sky, few trees or structures to interrupt the view of long plains. Deerfield is on a highway east of Greeley, Colorado. The road ribbons through fields with tall green crops. Now, in summer, I slow down to pass spidery farm vehicles rumbling on the shoulder. There's a green Department of Transportation sign that just says Deerfield, and I slam on my brakes. It's a dusty parking area next to two piles of weathered wood that clearly used to be structures, and a dirt road disappearing between them. I'm meeting George June here.
Hi, Dr. June.
I'm George.
I'm Aaron. Nice to meet you.
Hey, some,
yeah. So oh, thank you. I actually don't have a hat, but I have tons of sunscreen.
Oh, okay.
I'm going to switch on my mic real quick.
Yeah. I am Dr. George June, J-U-N-N-E, and I am in Africana Studies at the University of Northern Colorado.
Inspired by Booker T. Washington, and maybe by the 20 or so other black communities in Colorado at the time, George says O.T. Jackson had a dream.
He wanted to have a prosperous African-American community, and he did everything he could. There are people who came out here that were so poor, they could not do anything, and so he would loan them money so they could file on their homestead. And some of them had to walk part of the way from Denver because they didn't have money to get here. They couldn't take the train. So that's how desperate these people were. And they saw this as, this is going to be the way that I can become a full-fledged citizen and have a little bit of power and can pass this on to the children. So that's what this was. A lot of people thought that this was all about.
Why is it called Deerfield?
Oh, because the man who decided to, who's named it that, and it's spelled D-E-A-R, not D-E-E-R. He said, because this land will be dear to us. And so that's the name that stuck.
Now, what we did there was dry land farming. You know, you take a seed, you put it in the ground, you pray for rain. We didn't have a river nearby, we didn't have irrigation, we didn't have any of that fancy stuff. The first winter was rough. It was really cold. I mean, we had 5 horses and 2 of them froze to death. We had one wooden structure, which was my house, and the rest of the folks had lived in teepees and dugouts and made their shelters however they wanted to make them comfortable.
And when folks first came out here, the first winter, 1910-1911 winter, some people did not have the money or the way to build their cabin. So the first winter, there were some people who dug holes in the hillside and lived in the hillside for the winter. That's how desperate they wanted to own their own home.
And but it seems like that would have worked really well in terms of insulation and things like that.
Well, but you don't have a door, you just have a tarp hanging there. And so...
And out in the Eastern Plains, you know, they don't have trees out there. So if we wanted to burn something, we had to get sagebrush and cow chips and anything that we could burn. But we stuck it out. We made it through that first winter, and Deerfield grew. We had potatoes and corn and cabbage and rye and beans and turnips and melons and sugar beets, oats and alfalfa. I mean, we had cattle and chicken and horses and hogs and geese, ducks and turkeys. I mean, we were doing it. We had a general store. We had a filling station. We had two churches, we had a school, we had a boarding house, we had a cafeteria. I mean, people would come from miles around on Sunday to eat with us, you know, and I ran the kitchen, so, you know it was good. And you know we had a dance hall.
So there was one building that was the church, and it was also on Saturday night a dance hall.
So we had lots of fun on Saturday night.
And the people.
Squire Brockman. If you look to a picture of him, you wouldn't think that much of him because he was kind of a small guy and kind of hunched over. Didn't look very good, but the ladies loved him.
Why?
Well, you don't know.
Charismatic?
Yeah, apparently so. Some people say he was married a few times. And the last time he was married, he was in his 70s and he married a 20-year-old and they would stay married for about a year before she ran off.
Now, were most of the people here from Denver, or where were they from?
All over the place, Okay. All over the country. Many of them were from the Denver area. Sometimes they came to Denver from places in the South. Some of them, their parents were slaves and so forth. So they came from everywhere. And a couple of them were born slaves too.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So they must have been on the older side by 1910 or so.
Yeah. So, yeah, because slavery ended in 1865.
Yeah, so they would be at least in their 50s-ish.
Yeah.
It's interesting to think about, like, starting a whole new life in your 50s out in the Colorado Plains.
Yeah, and some of them had relatives out here, and others, Colorado had the reputation of not being as racist as many other communities on the East Coast, particularly the South, and also in the North.
The North. Of course, he means the broader North of the United States. But as Deerfield triumphed over its first winter and grew, just to the North, less than 200 miles away, the people of Empire, Wyoming were facing problems.
Right from the earliest days, there were racial tensions, and whenever something would disappear, somebody would misplace an item or lose an item, the black families would be accused right away of stealing.
There were threats of violence, of white mobs coming for black people, for their families. But a sort of savior came to town, somebody who had ideas for Empire.
In 1911 is when Russell Taylor arrives, and he is the driver who really helps create the community culture in Empire. He founds the church, he takes over the schools. He is the glue that holds Empire together.
Russell Taylor was a minister and a teacher.
And after doing that for several years, he brought his wife and their children out to join his brothers in Empire in Wyoming, and became the teacher and the postmaster and held several other prominent positions in the community as well. He was doing a lot to try and build respect for the Empire community. They were living the American dream, you know, taking raw land and trying to turn it into what, you know, in the New Testament they call the city on the hill.
The city on the hill. This is a sermon that Jesus gives in Matthew. He says his followers are, quote, the light of the world. A city built on a hill cannot be hid. Those words are a really big part of the American dream. Ever since 1630, when colonizer John Winthrop spoke to his followers on board the ship to New England, he dreamed of a city on a hill.
For we must consider that we shall be as a city upon a hill. The eyes of all people are upon us. So that if we shall deal falsely with our God in this work we have undertaken, and so cause him to withdraw his present help from us, we shall be made a story and a byword through the world.
And here, Reverend Taylor had a town called Empire. He knew what his work was. But as he wrote letters to the editors of newspapers across the Mountain West, as he taught students how to read, as he spoke at religious conferences, as he used everything he had to try to make Empire a model community and the world a better place, that Western seam of racism became even more exposed.
That's Modern West producer Aaron Jones. We'll have part two of the segment in just a moment. This is Open Spaces.
This time on the Modern West, small town politics might have a lot to teach about how fragile democracy has become.
The two commissioners we got this year, no one ran against them. Well, if there's no competition and no one from the other side pointing out what can be changed, that's when you get the blind spots.
It's part 11 of our Ghost Towning series. Find the Modern West under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Sponsored by Sheridan Travel and Tourism.
This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. We are sharing an episode from our Modern West Ghost Towning series. Once again, here's Aaron Jones.
Russell had a brother named Baseman Taylor. Baseman had farmed for a while, but he sold his equipment. By 1913, he worked in a restaurant in Torrington.
At some point, his family became concerned that he was a danger to himself. He had been suffering from what was probably depression and wanted him put in a hospital, I believe for that time it was called, for the mentally insane. They get the Goshen County Sheriff to come get him. He is beaten. And then he dies in the custody and is killed by the Goshen County sheriff.
Baseman hadn't committed any crime or violence. This was a lynching. Between 1904 and 1920, white Wyomingites lynched at least 5 black men. That means that in those years, Wyoming had the number one lynching rate in the country.
So I'm not talking about like the law and order lynchings in Laramie in the 1860s or 70s. We're talking about racially motivated lynchings, the murder at the hands of a mob.
After that, Russell Taylor poured himself into justice for his brother.
It broke his heart and infuriated him, as it did most of the other black individuals and families who lived there and knew what had really happened. And Russell actually filed suit against the county and the sheriff in an attempt to get some justice when the criminal court failed to do anything about the case. But his lawyers told him after few depositions and things that he could spend a lot of money pursuing this but would never win the case because he was a black man.
Of course, this racism was present across the country. But there weren't many black people in the West. Russell Taylor was trying to change that, but Empire was isolated in a sea of hostility. And its citizens were getting tired. Meanwhile, in Deerfield,
by 1920, we had 20,000 acres under cultivation. There were 700 of us there farming the land. And, we had houses and cars and fur coats, and we were just doing really well. But, you know, it didn't last. The first thing to happen is the war ended. World War I ended in 1918, and the price for crops, went through the floor. So that hurt us. Second of all, we had a big drought. The rain didn't come anymore. Thirdly, the depression hit, and then everything turned to a dust bowl.
With the dust bowl coming in, everything in eastern Colorado, into Kansas, Nebraska, just blew away. And so all the land just picked up and just blew away. I think 1/4 of the farms in the United States went under. And that's what happened.
And gradually, people couldn't hang on to their property. They lost it, turned it over to the banks or sold it, and gradually they started leaving Deerfield. I tried to advertise the property as a resort area to have people come and vacation and relax. But, you know, it's kind of hard because there's nothing but flat land and no trees. But that didn't succeed. So gradually, Deerfield became extinct.
I think about these some of these families that you mentioned that came out that were so poor that they had to walk part of the way. What happened to some of those folks when, you know, the 30s and the Dust Bowl came?
Some of them just gave up and they went to Denver and went to other places and stayed there. And that's all that they could do.
Because, so did they lose everything?
Yeah, they just left things.
Perhaps the descendants of Deerfielders live in Denver now, or somewhere else in the West. Or if they're not in the West, their roots are Western. Their ancestors were pioneers. And now, the Black American West Museum and others, including George June, are working to raise awareness about Deerfield and save its remaining structures. They've already poured funds into stabilizing O.T. Jackson's house. School groups come on field trips from all across the Front Range. One model for what Deerfield could be one day is Nicodemus, Kansas, a former Black town that's now a National Historic Site with a visitor center and a homecoming celebration every summer.
So the directions said to turn left in Henry, Nebraska.
I'm driving down a lonely country road right on the Wyoming-Nebraska border. It's August, late in the day. Faraway wildfire smoke tinges everything hazy, makes the sun seem closer to setting than it is. There are sunflowers everywhere. I'm looking for a cemetery.
And I'm driving back to see if I missed it somewhere.
After the murder of Baseman Taylor, Empire dissolved. One or two at a time, people left. No one knows exactly what the population of Empire was, but historians think at its height, around 1915, 40 to 60 people might have lived there. By 1930, only four people were left, and the Dust Bowl quickly swept those four away. No one knows where all those people went exactly. Todd Gunther has spoken with descendants in Casper, Wyoming, but those folks have since passed away. In any case, like the Deerfielders, anybody descended from the people of Empire have their roots in the West. They're integral parts of the Western story.
Don't think I'm seeing a cemetery,
though. On site in eastern Wyoming, though, little remains of Empire anymore, except for this cemetery. But I can't find it anywhere. Just these bucolic fields, fecund with corn. I turn around, and it's right there.
The Sheep Creek Cemetery. Inside the fence is the white people, the white, I guess, settlers or whoever that are buried here. And then outside of the fence are Black settlers. And the only thing that I can see is, I don't know, maybe like 50 yards away from the cemetery proper, there's a little bitty white square with a cross next to it. So I'm gonna go investigate.
For years, most people in Wyoming didn't know that Empire existed. And while I've been working on this story, most Wyomingites I've spoken to still don't. There was a thick silence around Empire for decades. Todd Gunther's white, and he says when he started researching the town, some of his colleagues resisted.
Have you encountered any resistance in Wyoming to your research or your talks about this?
Yes. When I was in grad school, I had people that tried to get me fired from my job and kicked out of grad school, and they didn't want to hear all of this. They preferred to hear the happy history. And the censored version of history, the whitewashed version of history. And so that's been an ongoing issue. I've been called a traitor to my race.
But in 2016, the Wyoming State Museum hosted an exhibit about Empire that has since turned into a traveling exhibit. In addition to Jake Freefeld's and Todd's research and the museum exhibit, there's also a new Empire historical marker now at a rest stop on I-25 near Wheatland. The marker was just erected last summer.
Okay, so here's a grave. It says Afro-American baby.
I can just find two Empire graves. That is, graves outside the fence, where Black people were allowed to be buried. The two spread far apart, like the living were making room for generations to come. Like there would be other families, new families, crowding in between. But there's only these two graves, far apart from one another, in a cornfield. How are we supposed to think about the extinction of a short-lived community? People were here. People lived here. I thought Carla Slocum might be able to help me think about this. She's an anthropologist at the University of North Carolina. She wrote a book called Black Towns, Black Futures: The Enduring Allure of a Black Place in the American West. She made time for me to ask some bumbling questions about places like Empire and Deerfield.
You've used the term ghost town a lot. The ghost town to me suggests a kind of place that is that has a void. It's a place that doesn't have anything to offer. It's a place that was and doesn't have anything that it offers us today. And so even if a place that formally existed, was incorporated before, but is no longer formally existing and is not no longer incorporated and maybe has no physical residence in it anymore, it still is a place that has a lot of significance to people who have an affiliation with that place.
So all these towns we're talking about in this whole series, not just Empire and Deerfield, but Walden too, and all the shrinking towns in the rural West, they're not voids, and they won't become voids. They're important. They have meaning. Maybe it's time to rethink what success means.
The very popular fascination with Black towns is about what they were, that they have these really remarkable histories. The word remarkable is often used to describe them. They are places where people of African descent, Black people, came together, created these communities, and in many cases, they were vibrant places. They were places that provided people a sense of security, a relative sense of security, I should say. And were part of their quest for achieving freedom and safety during the Jim Crow era.
Carla says Black towns are success stories, whether they're former Black towns or current ones.
Deerfield was a successful, highly successful farming community. And you can't tell it now. After the Dust Bowl, it just disappeared. But it was a highly successful farming community.
Because it had bumper crops. Because it grew so much food that in addition to what they sold, Deerfielders donated food to Black orphanages in Denver. Because there was a blacksmith who was a ladies' man. Because there were dances. Because there were places to find God. Because there was a man who had a dream and did everything he could to make it happen.
It was a wonderful dream. It was a good dream. It was a great project, and it was also a dear dream.
O.T. Jackson died in the 1940s in his house in Deerfield. He was the last person living there.
Why do you think it's important to tell the story of places like Deerfield?
Oh, that's part of a good part of history. I mean, it's fantastic history. With these pioneers no experience, coming out here, just saying, I'm going to take the big chance and doing it and succeeding.
There has been this whitewashing of Western history, and to a certain extent, Midwestern history as well. This tells a story of generations of African Americans who some came out of slavery, went in their lives from being owned to owning land.
People think of myths as something that's not true, but a myth is something that's deeply true. It's so true, it tells us who we are. And myths come from stories.
You know, if we're going to tell the American story, and if we're going to tell American history, we need to have it complete. And there are so many silences around the Black presence that this Black Town story is one of those parts that helps add to and round out the American story.
Do you ever think about all those people in America dreaming? Dreaming of freedom, safety. Dreaming that they can use their skills toward dignity and independence. Dreaming of sunflowers, a wide blue sky, endless room to be your own person. Imagine two towns, houses clustered together against the wild plains. Night falls. And people dream.
If you want to hear more episodes from the 12-part Ghost Towning series of the Modern West podcast, click on the podcast tab at wyomingpublicmedia.org. You can also listen to the Modern West wherever you get your podcasts. When we come back, we'll hear a story about an artist who overcame challenges. This is Open Spaces.
One thing we're proud of here at Wyoming Public Media is our podcasts. Whether you're looking for a good story from human nature,
I was convinced some of them are going to die,
or you want to hear our region in unexpected ways through the Modern West.
When women teach women, we're saving relationships one cast at a time.
We've got a whole world waiting for you online. Explore under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
In Superior, Wyoming, near Rock Springs, there's a mural that reflects a resilient spirit. It's painted on a large flat rock face along the railroad line and bears giant images of reclining nymphs, topped by Japanese characters that read, "People of the world, watch my future." That inscription proved true for the late artist Paul Horiuchi, who created the mural. Wyoming Public Radio's Nina Rouse speaks with his son Vincent on how his father was able to believe in hope despite the hardships and challenges he faced.
Paul Horiuchi was 14 years old when he immigrated to the U.S. from Japan in late 1920. His family already settled in Wyoming earlier, and Horiuchi followed suit.
His older brother was already working in the railroad.
That's Paul's son, Vincent Horiuchi, speaking, also better known as Vinny.
Unfortunately, his father died 2 years later from stomach cancer, but he and his brother made a good career at the railroad. My dad was smart and spoke no English at the time, but he did learn Spanish very quickly.
His Spanish got him a promotion at work, and soon he and his brother started making a lot of money.
Eventually, he was looking for a wife, and he had a relative in Seattle who sort of arranged a marriage, but it was mainly for his brother, Tom. But when my dad saw her, he came out here and met her, and he really hit it off. So he went back and said, "Sorry, I'm marrying this woman." And he did.
Paul Horiuchi and his wife, Bernadette Suda, soon made Superior, Wyoming their long-term home, where Paul created the World Watch My Future mural using a railroad spike while he was working for Union Pacific. And they loved it there until World War II broke out.
So my dad lost his job. He had 24 hours to pack his stuff up and move his family out of that nice house that they had lived in. And so for the next few years, they just roamed around because they did not have to go to the camps because...
He's referring to the Japanese internment camps here.
Japanese at that time, anyone who was not on the coast wasn't moved to the camps. So my mom said that they weren't even as well off as the people in the camps because they had nothing to eat, no place to stay, no money.
Paul took random odd jobs like picking sugar beets to get by. By 1944, the family ended up in Spokane, Washington, where Paul got a job at an auto body and fender repair shop. And he quickly became really good at his work, especially with matching colors of paint on automobiles.
And that was the only way to keep up his painting.
So he spent more time working on his art, winning his first prize at the well-respected Washington Fair. The next year, a watercolor piece of his won an honorable mention in the Seattle Art Museum's annual Northwest Exhibition.
Then after that, he had his first one-man show, and it sold out. He was stunned. He couldn't believe that he could do this.
How did you come across your father's mural in Wyoming if you were residing in Seattle?
Well, we would take family trips. My mom, my dad, and I would visit his brother and his family in Wyoming. We did that a couple times that I remember as I was growing up. He told me about the mural before, so one of our trips out there, we went to it in Superior, and yeah, it was still there. He knew exactly where it was, and so we climbed up to it, and he even found one of his spikes that he had used to carve the image. And so he kind of cleaned it all up while he was there, and that was it. You know, we hardly had any pictures at the time. He didn't make a big deal about it. He just liked that it was still there.
So you read the words, "People of the world, watch my future."
Yes, it's carved on there.
Right. Did you ask him what he meant by that?
No. He knew that he was destined to be an artist. He didn't know how good of an artist he was going to be, but that's all he cared about.
What was your impression when you read those words in your father's mural? Like, what did you think?
At the time, you know, I just thought, you know, that's Dad. You know, he's a humble guy, so it was a little surprising, but
yeah.
You know, he was just so dedicated to his art that something was going to happen, and it did. With my mom's encouragement, that's what his life became. Otherwise, he would have just gone back to body and fender work. But my mom told him, no, just keep painting. So that's what he did. And then when people started buying, then, you know, it really sank in for everybody. Maybe my mom had the confidence, but the rest of us, you know, we had no idea that he would develop into this talented person.
It's just interesting that he wrote, "People of the world, watch my future," and it's actually happening. It's like he predicted that the people of the world is watching, because I'm here now watching his future.
He was modest but confident, I think. He just knew that he was born to do this.
Vinny Horiuchi, thank you so much for talking to me. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. The show and segments are available on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.